I swiped right and thought I'd found someone normal. He messaged me within seconds, complimented my smile, asked about my day. A week later, I realized I was trapped. Every notification felt like his heartbeat in my pocket. I couldn't pause. I watched my reflection for signs of change. Was I smiling too much? Texting too little? He sent screenshots of my Instagram stories, claimed he just happened to see me out with friends. His words felt caring, protective. My friends said red flags. I ignored them. I told myself obsession meant passion. He knew what I did before I met him. He guessed my coffee order. He remembered my childhood dog's name. He sent a map of my commute each morning with an emoji at my office door. I told him it was sweet. I told myself I was safe. Then the call started. At first, for a day. Just checking in, he said. Then 8. I fell asleep to the glow of his incoming number. I stopped working. I stopped seeing my friends. My phone buzzed during meetings and I answered. I felt warm when I saw his name. I felt cold when he didn't reply. I found a sticky note on my bathroom mirror. I miss you. I felt a rush, then panic. I texted back. He replied, good. Stay. Something inside me cracked. I sat on the bathroom floor, phone in hand, tears on my cheeks, wondering who I'd become. I thought I knew the risks. I thought I'd stay in control. Instead, I'd let him tighten his grip one, I love you at a time. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 1. First Swipe. I opened the dating app just before sunrise. My kitchen was dim, the coffee pot humming in the background. I scrolled through faces, landscapes, bios. Each profile promised connection. Each promise felt hollow after so many left swipes. Then I saw him. His name was A. His eyes looked warm in his single profile picture. He smiled, head tilted, casual shirt, unpretentious backdrop. Something nudged me to tap the heart icon. Within seconds, a new message appeared. I sat straighter. My heart fluttered. He wrote, "Your smile lit up my phone screen. What's your favorite way to spend a Saturday?" His compliment was simple, direct. It felt genuine. My finger hovered over the keyboard. Then I typed, "Hey, thanks. I like slow mornings and old bookstores." "You?" he replied almost instantly. "Slow mornings sound perfect. I'm more of an early riser. Coffee in one hand, a jog in the other. I grew up near the water, so I like the breeze at dawn." He included an emoji of a sun rising. I sent a heart. Grooming begins with warmth. A manipulator uses rapid-fire attention to create comfort. This tactic is called love bombing. It feels like falling into soft light. It feels safe. It feels special. I learned the term love bombing from a friend who read pop psych blog posts. I remembered her warning. It's easy to confuse intensity with authenticity. I typed back, "I read about love bombing once." He wrote, "Explain." I paused. I told him roughly what I knew. He replied, "I get it. I'd never do that." I felt relieved and believed him. By the second day, our conversation spilled across every hour. I lounged on my couch, phone in hand, laughing at his jokes. He mirrored my tone. If I used an exclamation mark, he used two. If I asked a question, he asked three in return. Mirroring makes you feel understood. It feels true. It feels effortless. Mirroring and love bombing work in tandem. First, a manipulator offers praise so lavish it overwhelms your radar. Then they echo your language so completely that you lower your boundaries. You share more. You trust faster. On day 3, he sent a voice message. His voice was calm, confident, warm. He said, "I wanted to hear your voice. Books are great, but voices are real." My chest tightened. Was it too soon to share my phone number? I typed, "Sure," and hit send. He called moments later. I shoved my phone into my ear and smiled at the ringing light. "Hey," he said. His voice felt close. "Safe." He asked if I minded sharing my address so he could send flowers. He said he loved flowers. I told myself it was thoughtful. I gave him my street name and apartment number. He said, "I want to know you're safe." I tucked my phone under my pillow and settled back into my sheets. A small thrill pulsed through me. I liked that he cared. By day 5, he knew my work schedule. He knew the route I took to the office. He guessed my coffee order. Oat milk latte with a shot of vanilla. He asked if he could surprise me at the cafe on Monday. I hesitated. I pictured him leaning against the counter, one white rose in hand. I pictured gasping in delight. I typed, Okay, but just coffee, he replied with a thumbs-up emoji and the words, can't wait. I told a friend about the coffee date. She messaged back. That's creepy. I texted her assurances. He's not creepy. He's courteous. He listens. My words felt hollow even as I typed them. The theory phase covers grooming in detail. Grooming uses attention to fast-track intimacy. It cuts through skepticism. It triggers brain chemicals that mimic genuine affection. Targets start to believe the manipulator's pace is normal. That afternoon, I replayed our messages. I noticed patterns. He used my nickname twice. He recalled casual details. He asked open-ended questions. He apologized if he paused too long. He never let the conversation run cold. He punctuated every text with warmth. Heart emojis, compliments, reassurance. I felt seen. I felt valued. Example phase highlights real behaviors. A manipulator wants to own your attention. They schedule conversations. They plan small surprises. They seed your day with reminders of them. The constant presence breaks down your mental walls. On Monday, I arrived at the cafe early. My heart pounded when I saw him. He stood near the counter clutching a cup of coffee and a single white rose. His eyes met mine. I waved. He smiled, tucked the rose into my book bag pocket, and handed me my latte. I thanked him, feeling both shy and powerful. He sat across from me, leaned forward, and said, I studied everything you posted on Instagram. I wanted this date to be perfect. My chest tightened. My mind spun. Evidence of scrutiny felt flattering and violating at once. He said, I don't want surprises that upset you. I want to know you. I told him that was sweet. I told myself it was harmless. Defense strategies belong in every chapter. At love bombing stage, share minimal details. Delay responses. Keep a friend looped in. Treat rapid attachment like a red flag. Practice saying no. I sipped my latte, remembered those guidelines, and tested him. I said, thanks for noticing my habits, but I like a bit of mystery. He paused. He nodded, smiled, then asked about my weekend plans. He adjusted. He respected my boundary. I felt proud. When I returned home, I cleared my message history. I turned off notifications from the app. I opened my calendar and blocked Monday mornings for quiet time. I messaged him later that evening. I enjoyed coffee, but I need space. I'll text tomorrow. He replied, understood. Sleep well. I set my phone aside and took a deep breath. I felt the relief of a small victory. I reminded myself, real connection grows slowly. Real affection survives boundaries. I fell asleep with my phone on silent and a sense of control. Tomorrow we'd see if he waited. Tomorrow we'd see if he listened. Tomorrow I'd test if he valued me or just my attention. I drifted into sleep, clinging to that question. Chapter 2. Attention turned tight. I woke to 20 missed messages. My phone lay face down on the nightstand. The glow from the screen etched my name. I flipped it over and read him. Good morning. Did you sleep well? I paused. My chest tightened at the sight of his name. It was early. It was insistent. I pressed back. Morning. I slept fine. He replied instantly. Great. Coffee later. I typed. I have a call at 9. Maybe afternoon. He sent a thumbs-up emoji. Under that he wrote, You choose time. I'll be free. I closed the app, seeking calm. By sunrise's end, I had learned a new rhythm. My day orbited around his messages. Each ping fractured my concentration. Each reply felt like a test. I told myself it was harmless. I told myself it was normal to talk all day. After all, he claimed he valued communication above everything. Intermittent reinforcement drives obsession. When attention is unpredictable, the brain craves the highs of engagement. At first, messages were constant and sweet. Then he slowed, withheld texts, then delivered an onslaught. I chased his replies. I stored screenshots. I felt the familiar flutter when I saw his name. I felt the sting when I didn't. That afternoon, I sat in a meeting and felt my pocket vibrate. My heart lurched. I texted under the table. Stop calling in meetings. He wrote back 5 seconds later. Sorry. I just worry. Did I upset you? I typed, I need focus. He replied, sorry. He added, I miss you. The fluctuations lulled me. Soft apologies followed by overt affection. The pattern repeated. Pleasure, withdrawal, craving. It felt like a moth drawn to heat. It felt impossible to turn away. Theory 40%. Intermittent reinforcement, is the core of compulsion loops. A target learns that attention is an erratic reward. They never know when the next compliment, apology, or surprise arrives. They remain hypervigilant. They habitually check their phones. They replay conversations, dissect tone, anticipate replies. This unpredictability spikes dopamine more than constant rewards. It forges emotional dependency. Example 35%. On day 10, he texted, "I found something that reminded me of you." I replied, "What?" He sent a photo of a vintage vinyl record, one I mentioned loving months ago online. I gasped. How did he know? I scrolled back and saw I'd posted about it 6 months before. He wrote, "I keep notes on you." My chest turned cold and warm at once. I told him, "That's crazy." He replied, "I just like knowing everything about you." At lunch, I sat with friends. My phone buzzed in my bag. I couldn't help but peek. He'd sent a text. "I'm outside." I shot up and raced to the window. He stood under a tree, coffee cup in hand. He waved. My friends stared. I said, "He's just being thoughtful." One friend whispered, "He's stalking you." I shook my head and told them I invited him. I told them I felt safe. That evening, I tried to enforce boundaries. I typed, "Let's slow down. We need time apart." He responded, "Why? Don't you like me?" I wrote, "I love talking, but I also need space to work and think." He answered, "I don't understand." He added, "If you wanted space, you'd say it differently." He didn't respect my words. He ignored my boundary, then accused me of rejection. Defense 25%. Recognize intermittent reinforcement. It feels addictive. To resist it, schedule phone breaks. Disable notifications. Use airplane mode during work. Track messages in a journal. Reflect on how you feel before and after responses. Notice emotional peaks and crashes. Share patterns with a friend. Late that night, my resolve cracked. I opened the app. I saw 30 unread messages. I scrolled through apologies, question marks, hearts. He wrote, "Please don't leave me." I felt a rush of guilt. I texted, "I'm here." Then, "I'll try to reply faster." Within seconds, he sent, "You're amazing." A fleeting high lifted me. Over the next 2 days, our exchange ballooned. He sent hourly check-ins. "You okay? What are you doing? I miss you." Each question felt caring. Each demand felt urgent. I juggled my calendar around his messages. I canceled lunch plans. I cut a work call short. I told myself it was temporary. I told myself I just needed to keep the peace. But each concession cost me something. I lost minutes of focus. I lost moments with friends. I lost confidence in my own schedule. I felt tethered to his digital presence. Theory deep dive. Escalation of demands follows a pattern. Initially, manipulative partners ask small favors. Then they ask larger demands. They frame them as care. They cast any refusal as betrayal. Over time, the target internalizes guilt. They equate boundaries with callousness. They abandon routines. They reorganize life around the manipulator. Example spotlight. On day 14, I planned a weekend getaway with my sister. I told A I'd be off-grid Saturday morning to Sunday evening. He texted, "Don't leave me hanging. Send me pictures." I replied, "I want a break." He countered, "A break from what?" "Us," I said. "From constant texts." He responded, "Fine. Go away then." He added, "If you're serious, I'll let you be." I felt deflated and anxious. That night, I packed my bag. My sister knocked at the door. "Ready?" she asked. I doubted my choice. I texted A. "I'm on my way." He wrote back, "Come back soon." I smiled weakly. During the drive, I felt lighter. No buzzing phone. No urgent pings. I called my sister. We laughed. We reminisced. I felt normal. I hugged her at the cabin door. I dropped my bag and exhaled. Defense tactics. Practice firm communication. Use assertive statements. "I need space. I will respond later. This is important to me." Do not apologize for boundaries. If pressured, repeat the statement calmly. Enlist a friend for support. Share your itinerary. At sunset, I turned off cell service. I watched fireflies dance. I felt a breeze touch my face. I realized how much I'd missed solitude. I realized how drained I'd been. I felt grateful for distance. I returned Sunday evening to a storm of messages. Over 90 unread. He wrote, "Where are you? Are you alive?" Panic flooded me. I texted, "I'm fine. Sorry for the silence." He replied with relief, then anger. "You scared me. Don't do that again." He didn't ask why. He demanded compliance. I considered ghosting him. I considered silencing his number. I considered walking away. But then I saw an apology. "I'm sorry. I just care so much." It felt like a bomb. I texted back, "It's okay. I'm here." That night, I lay in bed listening to my own breathing. I questioned my reactions. I questioned if self-care meant enduring his mood swings. I questioned if my loneliness justified his intensity. Theory wrap-up. When attention becomes control, it shifts from caring to coercion. The line blurs when love bombing evolves into demand bombing. Constant messages feel like affection until they suffocate autonomy. Example conclusion. By day 17, I tracked our patterns. I realized he only paused when he knew I was busy. He only apologized when his demands hurt me. He never asked what I needed. He only needed me to respond. Defense strategy consolidation. Set non-negotiable boundaries. No texts before 10 a.m. No messages during work. No surprise visits. Use tech tools. Mute notifications. Use do not disturb. Set auto replies. Practice self-trust. Honor your own rules. Prioritize your plans over his demands. I drafted a boundary manifesto. I posted it on my mirror. I control my time. I decide when to respond. I deserve space. I saved it as my lock screen. I closed my eyes and repeated it. Tomorrow, I'd test the manifesto. I'd let his messages wait. I'd reclaim my focus. I'd choose myself over compulsion. I drifted into sleep, resolved to hold my ground. Chapter 3: Invasion of Boundaries. I opened my front door to find a plain white envelope tucked under the mat. My heart skipped. I picked it up, turned it over, and saw no return address. Inside was a Polaroid photo of my living room. Taken through the window, I realized from the front yard. My coffee table and throw blanket lay untouched. A single line was scrawled beneath the image. "Missing you." A chill ran through me. My home felt penetrated. The space I believed sacred, private, safe. He had entered it without permission. On day 18, A had used my street number to send flowers. Yesterday, he'd taken my address to deliver a candle. Today, he'd watched me through my window. I slid the photo back into the envelope and placed it in my purse. Surveillance is the third phase of manipulation. After love bombing and intermittent reinforcement, a manipulator begins to dismantle boundaries. They shift from digital monitoring to physical observation. They justify it as care, concern, protection. They claim to want to know you're safe. But safety is a mask for control. I recalled my friend's words. "Trust your gut." My gut screamed. Yet I hesitated. I rationalized. He said he loved me. He said he worried. He said he just wanted to protect me. Maybe I'd overreacted. Maybe I was being paranoid. Theory 40%. Surveillance tactics fall into three categories: digital stalking, in-person monitoring, and third-party reconnaissance. Digital stalking includes checking social media posts, tracking location via apps, mining friends for updates. In-person monitoring escalates to following targets in public, dropping in unannounced, or using delivery services to scope routines. Third-party reconnaissance involves enlisting others, friends, coworkers, random services, to gather information. Each tactic chips away at privacy. Each breach rewrites the boundary map of the target. Example 35%. On day 19, I met my best friend, Sienna, for lunch. I unlocked my phone to check directions. An alert popped up. A wants to share his live location. I tapped allow without thinking. A dot blinked on a map, just outside the restaurant. I looked up. Sure enough, I saw his familiar dark Honda parked across the street. My chest tightened as I balanced my phone, pretended to text a coworker. After lunch, I walked toward the subway. My phone beeped. A location ping. "I'm following your Uber." I froze. I stared at the map. He'd tapped his rideshare app to mirror mine. My sense of safety collapsed. That evening, I scrolled through my direct messages and found a new follower, a private account. I clicked their bio. "Just a friend of A." I shrugged and accepted. The account posted a photo of me from a month ago, on a park bench, smiling at a book. The caption read, "I know her favorite bench." My breath caught. I closed the app. I thought about deleting my accounts, changing my routines, moving cities. I considered calling the police. I considered confronting him. Fear and confusion swirled. Defense 25%. To counter surveillance, start by auditing your digital footprint. Update privacy settings on social accounts. Switch to private, remove location tags, disable live location sharing. Review app permissions. Revoke location access for non-essential apps. Use strong, unique passwords. Enable two-factor authentication. Replace photo backdrops with generic images. For physical boundaries, vary routines. Take different routes to work, change coffee shops, schedule friend check-ins. Install motion sensor lights. Use blinds or curtains. If necessary, request no contact orders. Document every breach, dates, times, descriptions, screenshots. Share records with trusted individuals. That night, I implemented changes. I switched my Instagram and Facebook to private. I dove into settings and disabled location sharing across all apps. I logged out of my banking and rideshare accounts. I changed my passwords. I texted Sienna. "Would you mind walking me to the subway tomorrow?" She replied, "Of course." Relief flickered, yet fear lingered. On day 20, I parked at my favorite cafe and noticed a black sedan idling across the lot. My heart pounded. I grabbed my latte and hurried inside. Over the next hour, I surveyed the parking lot from every window. The car never left. Eventually, I left through the back door. I realized surveillance had seeped into every corner of my life. He no longer needed technology. He could follow me on foot. He knew my routes. He guessed my habits. Theory deep dive. Manipulators use geofencing to monitor targets via geolocation services. When app-based tracking fails, they revert to low-tech solutions. Following at a discreet distance, using public transport to shadow subjects or merging into crowds. They sometimes hire individuals to follow targets or manipulate mutual acquaintances to report on activities. This third-party reconnaissance introduces plausible deniability. "I didn't know it was wrong," I asked my friend. Example spotlight. On day 22, I arrived home late from work. The street lights flickered on. I noticed a delivery van parked near my mailbox, driver's seat empty. A small speaker lay on the pavement below my unit. It played ambient cafe music, my favorite playlist. I recognized it from my public stories. I froze. Someone had placed it to lure me outside. I looked around. No one in sight. My pulse raced. I jogged to my door, knocked loudly, unlocked, and bolted inside. I sat on my couch, trembling. The boundaries between public and private had vanished. I felt hunted. Defense tactics. If you detect physical stalking, notify authorities immediately. Provide vehicle descriptions, license plates, surveillance footage if available. Interview neighbors discreetly. Ask if they've seen suspicious persons or vehicles. Consider installing a security camera with cloud recording. Share your location only with trusted contacts via apps like Find My Friends set to fixed safety circles. That night, I called the non-emergency police line. The officer advised filing a report. I hesitated, worried about appearing overly dramatic. I thought, what if they tell me to come back when something worse happens? I ended the call, unsettled. On day 24, I rallied courage. I visited the precinct after work. I filed a report, complete with printed timestamps, photo of the envelope, screenshots of tracking pings. The detective said they would assign someone to watch my case. He suggested a restraining order. He handed me pamphlets on victims' rights. I left clutching the documents. I remembered my boundary manifesto on the mirror. I control my time. I decide when to respond. I deserve space. I added two new lines. I deserve privacy. I deserve protection. Example conclusion. By day 25, I noticed small shifts. He texted fewer location pings. He apologized for hurting my trust. He said, "I'll give you space." I replied, "Thank you." Yet part of me braced for the next surge. Theory wrap-up. Surveillance is a pivot point. It escalates from digital intrusion to physical encroachment. It signals a manipulator's transition from love to possession. Defenses must combine tech-savvy controls with legal and community support. Defense consolidation. Digital audit. Private profiles, no location sharing, strong passwords. Routine variation. Different routes, schedules, safe check-ins. Legal steps. Police reports, restraining orders, documented evidence. Physical safety, cameras, motion lights, trusted escorts. That night, I lay in bed, clutching the first photo envelope. I thought of the plants in my living room, safe behind glass. I thought of myself, vulnerable yet determined. Tomorrow, I'd test if my new boundaries held. Tomorrow, I'd monitor my own movements rather than his. Tomorrow, I'd reclaim my life. I drifted off, resolve hardening. I would not let him vanish my boundaries. Chapter 4, The Grip Tightens. I woke to the glare of my phone's lock screen. 30 missed calls. 75 unread messages. I pressed do not disturb. But I could still see the red notification badges stacking like threats. My wrist ached where I'd accidentally gripped my phone during a half-asleep reply. I slid out of bed and reached for my mug. The coffee was cold. I wandered into my living room, phone in hand. Each vibration felt like a jolt. The screen lit with his name. A. The pings never stopped. Isolation begins when communication intensifies. A manipulator tightens the emotional noose by demanding constant contact. They frame it as concern. They accuse any delay of neglect. They make targets feel guilty for independent moments. By day 26, I tracked my hours in his messages. Mornings, afternoons, evenings, nights, there was no break. On busy days, I rushed texts between meetings. On slow nights, I stared at my phone, waiting for him to speak or withdraw. Theory 40%. Isolation and emotional dependency stem from controlled communication. Constant messaging breeds anxiety when absent and relief when present. Over time, targets link self-worth to responsiveness. They learn that love equals availability. This cycle erodes external relationships, work performance, hobbies, and self-care. The manipulator becomes the emotional center. Example 35%. On day 27, I attempted a work presentation. My slides glowed on the conference room screen. My voice wavered. I thought of A's latest text. Good luck. Thinking of you. My heart fluttered. A colleague interrupted, asking a question. My mind snapped back. I apologized, stumbled through data, and finished early. Later, my boss pulled me aside. Everything okay? I forced a smile and said yes. I rushed back to my desk and opened the app. He'd sent a voice message. I heard you stumbled. Are you okay? Talk to me. I pressed play. His tone was soft but urgent. I felt torn between relief that he cared and shame that he'd unsettled me. I typed. I'm fine. Presentation went okay. He replied. I need to hear more. My chest constricted. Why did I owe him debriefs? I sighed and recorded another voice note. I told him the data points, my nerves, my adrenaline. He responded with empathetic sighs. I felt relieved that he comforted me. I felt trapped that I relied on him for comfort. I missed lunch with my friend Layla. I hadn't called my sister back. I stopped writing in my journal. I forgot my yoga class. My world shrank to two smartphones and one relentless heart. That evening, I tried to leave my phone upstairs. I planned a short walk. 5 minutes of fresh air. I slipped out, earbuds in, playlist loud. I strolled past the corner bakery. My phone buzzed. Where are you? I ignored it. Another. Please answer. My palm sweated. I stopped walking and texted. Just outside. I'll be back soon. He replied. Fine. But I worry. The guilt hit me like a wave. I turned and raced home. I unlocked my door and collapsed on the couch, panting. I told him through text. I'm here. He sent. Good. Defense 25%. To resist isolation, designate phone-free zones and times. Schedule uninterrupted blocks for work, friends, and self. Use app timers. Communicate boundaries. I will respond after 6 p.m., no calls during meetings. I need offline time. Share boundaries with friends so they can enforce them. Over the next 2 days, I enacted a communication schedule. From 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., I would respond only at lunch and end of day. I drafted a message. I value our conversations. For work focus, I will text at lunch and after 5 p.m. Thank you for understanding. On day 29 at 8:59 a.m., I sent the note. At 9 a.m., my phone lit with an immediate reply. Why can't you text when you think of me? My heart sank. I stared at the screen. I considered deleting the message. Instead, I held firm and did not answer until lunch. At noon, I texted. I'm okay. Here's my day so far. He replied with a thumbs up and heart emojis. relief fluttered. I realized relief had become my daily goal. That night, I hosted a small dinner with two friends. I placed my phone on silent in another room. I cooked pasta, laughed at old stories, felt genuine warmth. I noticed my phone glowing from the living room. It buzzed incessantly. I ignored it. I let my friends tease me. I felt alive. After dinner, I retrieved my phone. 130 unread messages. 50 missed calls. I scrolled. The first read, "I'm sorry I pushed. I just love you." My chest twisted. Love? I wondered. Theory deep dive. Emotional dependency arises when a target's self-esteem and mood hinge on a manipulator's feedback. Compliments become lifelines. Apologies become currency. The manipulator controls emotional supply. They trigger fear of abandonment, then offer reassurance. They keep targets off balance. Example spotlight. On day 30, I attempted to switch off notifications entirely. I set my phone to do not disturb, blocked his number for an hour, and closed the app. I planned to attend a late-night poetry reading. I sat in a candlelit cafe, listening to strangers share verses of pain and hope. I felt liberated. 30 minutes in, my phone buzzed on the table. An emergency override. A text from him. "This is an emergency. Call me now." My pulse lurched. I considered ignoring it. I weighed the possibility that something serious had happened. I called him. He rushed through tears. "I could be gone. I need you." My guilt washed away my freedom. I told him to breathe. I tried to ask what happened. He said his phone died. He worried I'd hurt myself. I apologized for worrying him. I promised to keep notifications on. He'd regained control. My moment of autonomy crumbled the instant he framed absence as crisis. Defense tactics. Use trusted emergency contacts external to the manipulator. Clarify crisis definitions. If a real emergency occurs, call this number. Do not reinstate notifications until you verify the situation independently. Practice self-validation. My safety is not tied to his anxiety. That same night, I felt hollow. I hovered between relief at hearing his voice and shame for losing my resolve. I lay in bed, phone at my side. I drafted a new boundary list. No override bypasses. No calls past 9 p.m. No guilt for silence. I saved it to my lock screen. But boundaries only work if a target enforces them. Each time I compromised, I taught him I would cave. Each apology I sent reinforced his power. Later, I dreamed of being underwater, trying to swim up for air. His hand reached down, pulled me back. I kicked and gasped. I woke with a start. My phone glowed with a midnight text. Had a nightmare. "Please call." I stared at the words. Tomorrow, I would test my new limits. Tomorrow, I would refuse guilt trips. Tomorrow, I would reclaim my nights. As I drifted towards sleep, I realized isolation was the centerpiece of his strategy. It fed his power and starved mine. I resolved to break the cycle. But resolve would not save me. Only action would. I tightened my grip on my phone and my own power. Tomorrow, I would pull free. Chapter 5, Breaking Free. I woke with the sunrise spilling through my blinds. My arm ached from sleeping curled around my phone. My lock screen, our boundary manifesto, glowed back. I control my time. I decide when to respond. I deserve space. I deserve privacy. I deserve protection. No override bypasses. No calls past 9 p.m. No guilt for silence. I stared at the words. I felt a surge of determination and dread. Today, I would enact the final defense. Exit strategies. On day 31, I drafted a departure plan. I shared my location with Sienna and Layla for 48 hours. I packed an overnight bag with essentials. Phone charger, spare keys, a change of clothes, toiletries, a notepad. I photocopied the envelope with the Polaroid and the printed police report. I sealed them in an evidence folder. I placed it inside my bag. Theory 40%. Exit strategies require preparation, legal support, and emotional reinforcement. Targets must anticipate manipulator retaliation, fear escalation, and guilt induction. Effective exits include securing safe housing, arranging trusted escorts, obtaining legal orders, and building support networks. They must address physical safety and psychological aftermath, trauma responses, self-doubt, and manipulator gaslighting. At 10 a.m., I texted A. "I need space to think. I'm taking time offline. Please respect my boundaries. I will reach out when I'm ready." My heart thrummed as I hit send. His reply came in 7 seconds. What's wrong? Did I do something? I ignored it. Example 35%. I met Sienna at our agreed spot, an all-day diner with vinyl booths. I slid into the seat opposite her. She handed me coffee. I opened my bag and showed her the folder. I'm leaving, I said quietly. She nodded, eyes fierce. I'm coming with you. We drove to a motel 2 towns over. I left no digital breadcrumbs, no check-ins, no story shares. I left my apartment key with the manager to change locks. I filed for a temporary restraining order online via the legal aid site Sienna found. I emailed the petition to the clerk and printed confirmation. At the motel, I locked the door and closed the blinds. I plugged my phone into a charger, turned off Wi-Fi, and disabled cellular data, except to receive critical calls. I set DND to allow only calls from Sienna and my sister. I breathed. That evening, I called the detective assigned to my case. He confirmed receipt of the report and order. He gave me a case number and patrol watch schedule for the next week. I wrote it down. I felt a fraction safer. Defense 25%. Exit strategies combine legal, logistical, and emotional actions. Legal: file police report, seek restraining order, document evidence. Logistical: secure alternate housing, change locks, vary routines. Emotional: enlist trusted escorts, notify support network, schedule therapy. Digital: limit sharing, strengthen account security, use burner devices if needed. I set my phone aside and watched the rain slide down the window. I felt raw, fragile, but freed. On day 32, ACE texts flooded in, dozens of them. Please talk to me. I love you. You can't leave. I'm scared. My hand trembled as I saw the notifications. I did not reply. I let them pile. By day 33, the messages slowed. I checked my phone twice and saw only missed call indicators. I ignored them. I spent the day with my sister, hiking on a foggy trail. We talked about childhood memories and silly family stories. I laughed without guilt. That night, I met with a counselor via telehealth. I explained grooming, intermittent reinforcement, surveillance, isolation. I felt shame, but also relief speaking aloud. She praised my steps. She gave me exercises to rebuild autonomy, journaling daily victories, meditating for 5 minutes each morning, reconnecting with passions. I felt hopeful. On day 35, the orders hearing occurred. I attended virtually from the motel room, phone on speaker. The judge asked me to describe incidents. I presented the Polaroid envelope, messages, call logs, police report. The judge granted a 6-month restraining order, a violation penalty, arrest. I exhaled, tears pooling. Example conclusion. With legal backing, my defense is solidified. I returned to my apartment under police escort. We changed locks and installed a security camera. I set up a safety plan with neighbors. I reviewed my digital settings again. I felt boundaries reinforced. I felt myself breathe freely for the first time in weeks. Defense consolidation. Maintain restraining order. Update neighbors and building security. Continue therapy and support groups. Practice boundary reinforcement daily. Celebrate personal autonomy milestones. That night, I opened my journal. I wrote, "Today I reclaim my home. Today I reclaim myself." I closed the journal and set my phone to silent. I placed it on the dresser, out of reach. I lay in bed, listening to the hum of the security camera. I felt safe. I felt strong. Tomorrow, I would rebuild routines on my terms. Tomorrow, I would explore old hobbies, painting, journaling, rooftop yoga. Tomorrow, I would remember that freedom is a practice, not a gift. As I drifted to sleep, I whispered to myself, "I am not his. I am whole. I am free."